We explore the role of comedy and the arts in times of trouble and in South Dakota today. From SDPB, today is Thursday, May 29th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, maybe we all need a good laugh about now. We will start West River at a comedy venue that encourages people to leave their troubles at the door for stand-up and shows 5 nights a week. Trevor Ryan is with us. Then comedian Nathan Hult will ask how one of the state's top comics got his start and what his mother says about his comedy shows. Plus, one of the great craftsmen of wordplay in the English language, we will explore the legacy of Shakespearean comedy and how mistaken identity and comic relief resonate with our experiences of humor even today. That's coming later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. There is a new location for laughs in South Dakota. West River Comedy has opened in downtown Rapid City. Club owner and stand-up comic Trevor Ryan stepped into SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio to take us down the stairs to the club.
Oh, it's really cool. We've tried to style it after those big city comedy clubs that you find down in the basement where it's really a hidden gem. The place has been around since 1888, and we've tried to lean into that history while also still, you know, creating a modern and clean atmosphere. So you come down and you're going to see our beautiful chandelier and the pictures of the comedians that have performed there so far. And you're going to get greeted by our staff and you're going to get showed to a great seat.
Yeah. 1888, what was it? What's some of the history of the building itself? Was it always a place to go laugh?
Or no, for a little while it was back in the day. It was West Dakota Improv at one time.
Okay.
But way back when, it was called the Recreation Inn officially, unofficially known as the Hole. And it was a pool hall and bowling alley, actually. There was a bunch of pool tables, and then the bowling alley actually went under the neighboring businesses next to it. There's no trace of the bowling alley left there now, but we've got a bunch of photos and everything. We try to, you know, keep that history going. It's really neat because they had a standing rule that said no women, no booze, and no cursing. And we allow all three.
All right. Good to know. Tell me why you think Rapid City, the Black Hills, South Dakota needs a nightly comedy club, 5 nights a week.
Well, we need to do more for the locals. I mean, we do so much for our wonderful tourists that come through to see our beautiful town, but we need more for the locals and not just another bar. Mm-hmm. People are always looking for something to do and to go out and to have a laugh. There's so much in the world today that we can find reasons to be mad about and to gripe about. You know what? Let's find a place where we can leave our troubles at the top of the stairs, go down, and just have a good time. And I think that's what I've been hearing from the customers. Most people, when they leave, they thank me. You know, they don't just say, oh, nice staff, you know, nice comic, nice this. They say, thank you. Thank you for bringing this here. And so it's just been great. This is my home, and I wanted to do something nice for it.
Let's talk a little bit about the audience experience. How do you be a good audience member at a comedy show, for example? And what might you leave with that people are going to say thanks on the way out the door?
That may be my favorite question I've ever been asked, but yes, to be a good audience member, you know, like I say, leave your troubles at the top of the stairs. Just come down to laugh. This is where I sound like a grumpy old man, where I think the TikTok generation, people think that comedy is just about fighting and about hecklers and owning hecklers and the back and forth between the audience and the comic. It's really not like that. These comics have been working on their material for a long time. They just wanted to make you laugh. If there's something that you're ever at any comedy show and you hear a joke that you don't like, well, that's just like being at a concert and you didn't like that song. Hang out for a second. You might like the next one.
So tell me a little bit about how you host then. How do you welcome people into the space, set them up to have a good time, create an environment where that's part of the experience?
Oh, yeah. No, I just tell them to sit down and shut up. No, I'm just kidding. No, I really am very genuine about thanking them just for being there and for supporting local business and supporting a small businessman that I am because I'm 5'2". I just try to make them feel happy about being there and try to keep the energy up and just let them know, like, hey, we all came to have a good time. As the host, that's my job. I've got to warm up the crowd, hand it off to my amazing comedians that can then just, you know, land that plane.
We all think, or we all enjoy, you know, hanging out with our friends in those moments or our family where we just start laughing about stuff. How do you take those kinds of experiences as a professional comic and bring them to the stage so where they translate to an audience?
Oh, wow. That's really the struggle, right? We try to find places where all of our lives are, I would say, sorry about that. Our lives become
what
Venn
do you
diagrams.
Say, what do you say to audience members when their phones go off in the middle?
I can't say that on SDPV.
Okay, let's just acknowledge that you left your phone on.
Yeah, we'll address that move. Yeah, oh my gosh.
So when I come to your set, I'm bringing my phone.
There you go. Yep, I deserved that. I absolutely deserved that. I hope you leave this in. But, anyway, oh my gosh.
You were talking about joke writing and like taking the thing that, because everybody thinks like I'm funny because you were in this moment. And you are funny. Everybody's funny. You know, in certain circumstances with your family and friends. And now you say, well, wait a minute, how do I tell that story? Or how do I get up on stage and turn that into art?
Yeah, it is very much remembering that although we are all individuals, our lives become Venn diagrams and they overlap with other people. Yeah. And where those Venn diagrams overlap, that's where you find common ground and that's where you find humor. Where it's like, hey, I had this experience the other day and oh my gosh, it made me laugh so hard. And you can say that to somebody else. And generally, there's somebody else in that room who was like, I know, right? That's crazy. You know, so that's, you try to find those moments where we find common ground.
Tell me a little bit about when you first realized comedy was a job.
Oh my gosh. The first time somebody paid me to do it. And then I thought, oh my gosh, this is great. But now I actually feel obligated to be funny.
Did you listen to records growing up? Did you like, you know, check out of the library, the big comedy records at the time? Did you watch an HBO special?
Yeah,
like who were those
absolutely.
People?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was really like, you know, in the early days, of course, Eddie Murphy, George Carlin, those kind of people just as a young kid. But then, you know, you don't realize they're doing that as a job. They're like, wow, they look like they're having fun. I wonder what they're like at work. Yeah. And not realizing that that's what they do. And then becoming an adult. And then I get into people like Louis C.K. or Big Jay Oakerson, which is a huge influence for me. And then you hear the stories of like, wow, it's a job. And you know what? It's not always that fun. Now, I want to do that. I want to be able to go up and laugh about it and then go off stage and go, why did I do that?
What are the themes that you come back to again and again as a comic in your own work?
Just a lot of like family life, military life, and just the travel that I've had. So I was born in Australia, came to the United States as a young, very young person, about 7 or 8 years old, traveled all over the U.S. and then got to travel all over the world in the military. And just those experiences that I have that, like I said, were, you know, we are all individuals, but I'm able to find Venn diagram crossovers with a lot of different people because of my, you know, diverse background.
Okay, so let's talk about the military, because I think military stories are hilarious as a veteran. And that was one of my core memories of being in the Marines, was how much we laughed. You know, you have these long stretches where you absurdly have nothing to do, but they've left you in the middle of a blizzard or something. And so you have nothing to do but make each other laugh. And I tell some of these stories, and you know, I'm not a comic, but other people don't find them funny. Other people are kind of mortified by some of the things. You're like, isn't that funny? You're like, no, it's not. So tell me a little bit about telling the story and translating it and then having it not translate because you haven't told it right.
Sure. Well, it must be more difficult for you because the problem they can't understand is that you have too many crayons in your mouth. But then once you swallow, no, I'm just fine. It's okay. See, I can say that because you're not in arm's reach of me. If you were in the room with me, I would never say that to a Marine because you just beat me up. So
I'll set down my crayons and take care of this. Yeah.
No, I think it's one of those things that I think, honestly, putting a name to that, addressing that, understanding that can be funny too, right, is saying that, like, I find this funny.
Yeah.
I know you don't. And, you know, sometimes leaning into that and pointing out, like, isn't this crazy that I used to laugh about this? There's those moments in a great comedy set where it gets real for a second. You know, it's almost like the musical breakdown. And we were in this really austere location, and my buddy just did this, and I just saw this horrible thing happens. And then you know what? Jimmy farted. And it was the best thing I'd ever heard in my entire life. You know, like people don't understand that it can be something as small as that's what you needed in that moment.
Yeah.
And that's what makes a really rounded out set, is to have those serious moments and then you're bang right back at it.
Was the Air Force inherently funny?
Sometimes, I have to say, like, I totally understand all of the grief that we got from the other services, because there would be times when we would have some sort of briefing or something would come up and you're like, there's no way the Marines are even talking about this. Like, you know what they're doing? Working right now. We're in a training class to learn what they did in basic training.
Or they've been left out in a blizzard somewhere. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, nobody's going back to get them because they're waiting.
Oh, don't worry. I did my Air Force required video SEER training, so I'd be fine.
No.
If I ever get captured, I'll be fine because I played that one little video game.
What are the themes that other comics come up in Rapid City and it just kills every time? Like, what's killing in the Black Hills right now as inherently
you know what?
Funny?
It's so funny you ask that. It's been coming up a lot lately, and I feel bad. Box Elder. Box Elder is catching a lot of flack. I don't know why. And I lived in Box Elder. Box Elder, I love you guys out there. But from a lot of, and it's mostly from the people that are from there. So maybe it's just, self-deprecating humor. But yeah, unfortunately, Box Elder is getting a lot of shtick. But also, it's the great, because we are so diverse, like we have got a great group of native comics that come with a really unique perspective.
Yeah.
And they're some of my biggest inspirations and friends, like Tyler Corbine, Sheldon Starr, some of the bigger names that are out there. They're just hilarious people. And being an outsider, I mean, I've lived here now 12 years. I mean, South Dakota is my home now. But first coming here, I didn't know a lot about that culture. And I learned a lot about it in some serious ways with some jobs that I had that I worked on the res for a while. And now I'm even learning more about it in a more humorous way and finding out there's ways that you can laugh about just about anything.
Yeah. Humor heals.
Absolutely.
Humor reveals the truth, shines a light on injustice.
100%. Yeah.
Anything?
I will say humor heals, but I have to say, if you're sick, go to a doctor still. I mean, don't come to the comedy club. I know.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The comedy scene in South Dakota is growing. Sioux Falls comedian, writer, and actor Nathan Hultz sat down with me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to share his story of falling in love with comedy.
I would say I'm a comedian first and foremost.
Stand-up sketch.
Comedian. I'll do sketch. Yeah, I have done, will do. I would say, I'm an ADD performer. So if I can do it, I will.
Yeah.
So I started acting, did improvise. I was an improviser for a long time. I coached improv at University of Sioux Falls for a year. And then I sometimes sit in with a couple improv groups in the area. And so I get to do that as well, because that's where it kind of started with my comedy career. And then I'm a stand-up. That's my main job. So I'm traveling the country, mainly the Midwest, but also the country, telling jokes.
So my kid, when she did that thing called SD My Life, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they give you like an aptitude test when you're a junior or senior in the Sioux Falls School District, or they used to. She's graduated a number of years from now. One of the things on her list of occupations she could consider was stand-up comic.
Oh, man. They're pushing that out? I wouldn't recommend that at all. I would say if there's other things on the list, don't include that one.
I think it was a random draw. Somebody else got sanitation engineer, so that's one of the... There's a whole bit you could
do
about
Do that. That's way better.
Which brings me to my question, which is how did you find your way into stand-up comedy?
Sure.
Because it wasn't through SD My Life.
It wasn't SD My Life. I grew up in Minnesota, and I wasn't going to go to college. And then my brother, I think at the behest of my parents, told me to come look at this school in Sioux Falls, where he's living at the time, and currently, but at that time specifically. Yeah. And so I went to and visited Augustana College, and they told me the stat that Augustana has for every one man, there's three women. And I was like, sold. Get me signed up.
And they led with that.
Yeah. I mean, it was in the tour. I don't think it was the first thing that I had heard. And so I was very excited to come to Sioux Falls and be here, because such a great community. Just visiting, I found just wonderful things, And then improv was a big part of my life in high school. We did something called Just Say No Improv. Have you heard of that?
No.
It's a type of improv.
See how I said no.
Nice.
Yeah, because you told me to just say no.
It's basically like it's high school kids going to junior high schools doing sketches and skits about staying off drugs and anti-bullying and stuff like that.
And it's funny?
It's supposed to be. Okay. It wasn't.
It is now, though.
We thought we were clever. It can be, it basically got me out of math class, so I was a big fan. And then when I went to college, I found that there was like an actual improv, like Whose Line Is It Anyway style. And they had classes on it, and they had coaching in a club, and I fell in love with it all over again. While I was going for theater, so I started as an acting major.
So you came to Augie largely because there were lots of women, and then you joined an improv club.
Yeah.
Which maybe cut down the odds a little.
Yeah, it did definitely cut down the odds. The theater department had a lot of great, talented women.
Okay, so in there to a useful. Yeah.
They also had a really incredible arts program. I joke a little bit, but their arts program was so wonderful. Julia Bennett, Ivan Fuller, mm-hmm. R.J. Fitzsimmons, who were my professors.
Yeah. What year did you graduate from Augie?
2012.
Nice.
Yeah, it took me a while. I started in 06. So, they tried to kick me out a couple times, but I made it through.
So you're in college and you're kind of discovering there's mm-hmm. classes.
Yeah.
In this.
Yeah.
And what was that like for you to like go to the first class and say, oh, I can learn this is a craft?
I'll be honest. Like, I was already part of the club before I took the class. Right.
Yeah.
So I was already kind of learning on the fly.
Right.
And the class was just like an excuse to do more of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I already been a huge passion for performing. I'd been on stage since I think the age of 8.
Nice.
I started doing plays and stuff. And I was always performing for my parents. Stuff mm-hmm. like that. And then after 6 years in college, a lot of your friends graduate because they're good students. And then I was not. And all my improv friends were graduating and moving across the country. And I was like, well, I could either start over with these new kids or I could learn to be funny on my own. And so I took my what should have been my senior year. I took an independent study on stand-up comedy. And some of the professors kind of would watch my act and give me notes on like what worked and what didn't. And then for my project at the end, we performed at a midnight showing in the Augustana Edith Mortensen Center.
Wow.
And it was 287 people.
Really?
And so the first time I did it 20 minutes in front of 287 people because I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
That's a long time to perform a monologue, essentially.
Yeah. So I'm going
to
be Chris Rock right now on Netflix.
Yeah. And in front of a sold-out audience.
Right. At Madison Square Garden.
I mean, my Madison Square
exactly.
Garden.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
You know? Like, it wasn't like a small studio show or anything like that. But yeah, it was, you know, right around finals time, everybody was looking to have a good time. And, I opened for our improv troupe.
Okay.
And so that had a little bit of I wouldn't say a following, but people were excited to see us. And we did a lot of marketing and kind of learned that aspect of it to get people
How
there.
How did it go?
It went
did
incredible.
You kill?
Yeah. It went, I mean, I rose colored glasses, but I think it went well. My mother,
It felt like you didn't go out and die
bomb.
And say, I'm never doing that again.
No. And that's the nice thing is I had coaching and help right away. And so I had someone telling me going, that's not very funny. Or, you know, like, do this. This doesn't look good. Or it seems like you're not. So I already had the performance aspect, which is one of the hardest parts of stand-up, I think, to learn. If you don't have someone telling you, like, hey, man. You look like a goof on stage or, you know, stuff like that. So I think I had like a little bit of a leg up just because I had a lot of help and people who are in the creative process guiding.
Yeah.
Even though they weren't stand up.
I'm an Augie grad too. And that's my experience at Augustana too. Like whatever you get that personal attention. Not that we're doing an ad for Augustana or that it's any better than any other wonderful South Dakota school.
Yeah.
But my experience there was very nurturing and, you know, what is it that you want to do? Well, let's figure out a way to help you figure out how to do that well.
And give
and to do it on behalf of your community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was really the a real swell option.
You know, that's a real swell option. Yeah.
My parents came. It was a midnight show for my much older parents.
Yeah.
My mother said it would be funny if it was someone else's kid, which I think is a quote on my website because it's still true.
Do you have material about your family?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So absolutely. It would be funny if it was somebody else's kid. Yeah.
It would be funny if it was someone else's kid. And I think
she knows.
I think there was I was on a list of people to pray for the next day at the Augustana Chapel. So I must have pinched a nerve at all.
That is quite a way to launch a career. So now you've figured out ways to do this in community in which you live. So first of all, for people who don't understand stand-up comedy versus improv.
Sure.
Help us make that distinction. Because sometimes people see a stand-up and they think it's improv, but it's really tightly crafted.
The most widely known example is Whose Line Is It Anyway? Like that Drew Carey show and the British show where they basically make up scenes, little plays on the spot. Yeah. A lot of times they'll have games where there's structure to that. But so you're working with another person, which is very different than writing all your funny, clever observations and then spitting them at a room.
We're improv-ing now. We didn't plan what we were going to talk about. We sat down. We're not necessarily trying to be funny, but we're improv-ing
exactly.
A radio conversation, I guess.
But we're doing that as characters that we're making up on the spot and stuff like that. So that's the big thing about improv.
I'm not a character that I'm making up.
Yeah. We all make characters. We all present ourselves as someone, right? Mm. Whether that's our true authentic or whatever.
So 100% authentic all the time. Can't be anything else.
That's the way to be.
Try to cover it up, just comes out.
Exactly. And that's what a good improviser does. Brings out themselves.
And then stand-up is more like you're going to start with material.
Yeah.
And 20 minutes is long because normally you might start with a five-minute set.
Three minutes, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
In Sioux Falls, we primarily stick to the five-minute structure. But if you go to, Minneapolis or some of the bigger scenes or cities, you're looking at even 2-3 minutes. One of the biggest podcasts right now is Kill Tony, and they do 1 minute on stage.
Really?
And you have to kill in 1 minute. And
is it harder to kill in 1 minute than it is to five?
I think so. Uh-huh. I think so. I think it's harder. I think it's hard. I think they're equally hard because they're different.
They're different. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe I can do really well for 45 to an hour. And I have a very hard time in 2 minutes and 3 minutes to really make it work. But I also tell more story. I'm a little bit more story based.
Right.
I like a narrative and plot twists and stuff like that. So my style doesn't really lend to a 1 minute set.
Right. So what kind of community and culture and comedy scene is there in South Dakota, in Sioux Falls, in the places that you're going? What's the comedy scene like on the tour? Help me understand that a little bit.
We have a wonderful scene, and it's small but mighty.
We as in Sioux
Falls? Sioux Falls specifically.
Because the whole state's listening. Yeah.
But Brookings has a great open mic. Aberdeen has some pockets of wonderful stand-up comedy. In West River, Rapid City, just opened up a comedy club. I'm going
to
be there October if
we're
I can
gonna
poke,
talk to
plug
them.
That.
Yeah.
And they fantastic place. There's some really great comedians over in Rapid City. I can name drop, but I probably should. So all across the state, great. But you're also pretty close to Minneapolis, so we see a lot of the Minneapolis comics coming up. We're Sioux City. Nebraska. So it's a small community, even in the wider network. So you get to meet everybody, and it's a traveling profession.
Yeah.
So you are driving to these places a lot of times 3, 4, or 5 hours just to go hang out and do 20, 30 minutes. but that's the gig, and that's why we do it.
Why do we need to, what's the role of this culturally? What's the role of comedy historically, culturally, politically? I know that's a big question that, maybe people write dissertations on. But in your opinion.
I think comedy has so many roles. and we as individuals can't fill all of them, right? But it's entertainment. Yeah. That first and foremost, it is something that can, if it's good, it's going to bring a smile to someone's face. And I think that's important.
Yeah.
My brother's a doctor. I provide the best medicine.
Yeah.
So, but truly, like, there's nothing better than if you're going through a hard time laughing. And so that's how I try to approach it. I try to put my values into it. I try to make sure that I'm representing the best of what I think and stuff like that without being pushy.
Mm-hmm.
But there are political comics, and they're very important because they're taking ideas and synthesizing and making people who wouldn't necessarily understand or completely understand the concept understand a concept and form an opinion based on a comedy bit. That happens now. I mean, if you look at The Daily Show, if you look at, you know, all of those shows and stuff like that. So I think that's important and also part of the culture and the importance of stand-up comedy. I just don't do that because I don't have that in me.
Yeah.
That's not my...
You're here to make people laugh and have a good time.
I would
leave
rather...
a smile on their face.
Yeah, I'd rather preach kindness and not preach, but like show kindness and show just like good. And I think the world needs that as much as we need
sharp political wit
and observations.
Yeah.
That's just not my thing. So,
tell me, what are the themes that you come back to again and again as you develop new work, as you hone the work that you have on the stage? What resonates with you?
I love acceptance. I really like...
How do you make that funny?
Second chances. Stories of my life. You know, I've had a lot of second chances. You might even say fifth, sixth chances. I make mistakes, and I'm lucky enough to have people forgive me. And I think because I, you know, also am kind to people and give them second, third, fourth, fifth chances. So I talk a lot about that. But they don't come out as that. They come out as, you know, me saying something stupid to my wife or, you know, making my daughter learn a rap song on accident, you know, stuff like that. Those things. But I think the themes, if you zoom out, don't zoom out too far. But if you zoom out, I think those are the themes that I keep coming back to. But honestly, if it's funny, that's what I want.
Yeah,
I can say any message I want. But really, I want something funny. I want you to enjoy your time. And then, you know, I can show you that it's okay to hug and cry afterwards.
So tell me a little bit about the process. You mentioned, you know, stage presence. Somebody walks on the stage. I'm in the audience. And I'm like, this person's supposed to make me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know me. I don't know them. I'm just trusting that I'm in a space where you're offering me something that is supposedly funny. What kind of stage presence do you have to pay attention to? Like you mentioned, professor saying, "Oh, I look like a dork." Well, maybe looking like a dork is funny. So how do you manage the personality that comes on the stage that signals to the audience what kind of comic that you're going to be?
That's a really good question. Being authentic to yourself is the most important thing, right? Like for some people, it's getting rid of like the habits, like the bad habits that you do unconsciously, right?
Okay.
So like playing with chords. You can tell a comedian isn't that comfortable if they're playing with the chord. But also some comedians who are very comfortable on stage are just playing with chords because that's what they do, right? So it works for some people and it works for other people. You know, it's when you'll feel it, as an audience member, you'll feel it. You don't know why, and you won't know why you're either uncomfortable or very comfortable with that person. Right. Because there are comics that have this shy demeanor or are very quiet or have this kind of odd, kooky personality. And that works for them. Right. Because that's it's their style.
Yeah.
Right. So there's no wrong answer in comedy. There's just general practices.
What works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
What makes people laugh and what doesn't make people
laugh.
Exactly.
So there's no hard and fast rule, which is kind of the cool thing. There's no one path, right? Yeah. It's not just knock, knock, who's there. There's, you know, why'd the chicken cross the road? There's all of these different styles of jokes and way to tell them. And so it's a really open format. Your canvas is laughter. Mm. However you get that happen, you know.
Yeah. How do you prepare then?
Sure.
When you're writing down material, you're having a conversation with your wife, you say something stupid.
Yeah.
How big is the gap between the moment that you say something stupid and the moment you think, gonna have to write that down?
So pretty often, most people that know me and have known me for a long time will just understand that in that moment, I have to write it down.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'll never remember it. And so a lot of times I'm pausing conversations and like, hey, excuse me, 1 second. And I will literally take out a note on my phone, or if I have the notebook on me, I'll literally scribble something down right there in that moment. And they're like, well, is this going to be on stage? Maybe. Right.
Yeah.
I have the kernel, the nugget. But the big thing is like looking inwards. I always found, because I tell stories, and it's hard for me to tell a story about someone else's story. So I kind of look towards my stories and my experiences. But I also talk about, you know, Carlos Santana has a line of footwear. so seeing these observations, you have the idea, and then you can build that out, right? It takes years to figure out what's funny right away. You know what I mean? Like, if that's an idea that'll work, or if that's not. But you still have to write all of them down because something could be. So I've always said, when people are talking about, like, I want to start doing stand-up comedy, my advice is the difference between a funny person and a comedian is a notebook. If anything comes across your mind that makes you laugh, write it down.
Yeah.
You can figure out structure later, right? But having that book of ideas, that idea, you can figure out how to write a joke. That's something you can learn. There's thousands of books on it. There's a lot of ways you can.
Yeah.
If you talk to any comedian, they'll love to talk to you about how to make a joke.
Yeah.
But it's easier to start from an idea.
Yeah.
And mold it. Yeah. You know?
Have you ever bombed or failed on stage, or material has failed to land? How do you deal with that? Because that's why many people are afraid of doing it, especially in the age of social media, where, you know, not only are you going to bomb in a dark club somewhere, you know, in New York City, which is terrifying.
You're going to bomb on the internet.
You're going to bomb on the internet. Or you're going to bomb in front of your college, you know, class as a senior. Or you're going to bomb in Sioux Falls, where people are going to see you the next day walking around downtown. But you don't want to be the guy that goes viral for being bad.
No.
Or that might be the story that you're telling yourself. Maybe you do. Maybe that makes you popular. But most people are afraid of failure on stage. Have you failed?
Lots.
How did you handle it?
Constantly. You can't get better without it. So if you're failing on stage, that means you're trying something new, right? And so you just got to keep trying something new. I've had stuff that works everywhere else except for one room, and it's the worst feeling in the whole world. It is truly one of it's just a moment of, it's like falling, and you have no idea what's going to happen next, but you know it's not going to be good. But at the end of it, you're still alive. And now you can go over that, right? That a bomb is an opportunity to get better.
Yeah.
Right? And so I'm fortunate enough to have a lot of experience. I've been doing this 15 years, that when I bomb, I do have tricks to get myself out of it. Right. If I have a longer set, if I'm at 5 minutes, my tricks aren't going to work. Right.
Yeah,
if I'm bombing at 3 minute, 4 minute mark, I got to get off stage in a minute.
Yeah.
You know, I might have a quick joke that'll work and maybe get them at least, you know, ready for the next person to hopefully do better. But I can remember I had just gotten back from San Diego. I had taken fifth out of 250 comics in the San Diego Comedy Festival.
Wow.
And, my daughter was about to be born, and I was like, I think I could retire. I think I could be done with stand-up comedy. And I did a showcase in Sioux Falls, and I just bombed so hard. I wasn't prepared. I was overconfident. I wasn't ready. I wasn't sure what jokes I wanted to tell, and I just did so poorly. And I was like, I walk outside the venue and I'm like, oh, it's just the audience. It wasn't me. I'm very good. And then the next comedians just did so well with the same audience in the same room and the same lighting. And I was like, that can't be my last set. And so I've been doing it for another 7 years, you know? So, you know, but bombing is part of it, unfortunately. But a great comedian is never going to just do great all the time. They have to try and work it out, and that's how you find your voice.
Yeah.
And what's funny and what isn't.
Yeah.
If everything's funny, everything you say is funny, you'll never grow. And so just know that it's part of it, you know? You know, part of being funny is sometimes not hitting.
And sometimes not being funny.
You know, not every batter in baseball hits 100% of their swings, you know?
Yeah. So. How do you handle when somebody else bombs? You know, how do you be supportive if the person coming off the stage just did terrible? Like, you're feeling nervous, like maybe it's the crowd and that's about to happen to me.
Yeah.
But then you also have an awareness that, like, man, I got to say something to, or do you just not talk when that person ignore
it? It depends
on
how well
the other way, like when a toddler falls.
Depends on how well you know that person.
Okay.
You know, like, hey, man, you know, but you've been there. You know that it's like there's nothing in that moment that I can say to a comedian that's like will flush away every emotion they just felt. But you can say, hey, man, get them next time.
Yeah.
But again, if you've been doing it any amount of time, it's part of it. Bombing is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you learn to get better. Oh, and the people that don't learn don't keep doing it. Or they keep doing it and they just don't get better, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to feel that feeling. They're going to get used to that feeling. And that I think is the saddest thing to me, is someone not growing.
That's comedian, writer, and actor Nathan Hultz. For more information on local shows, you can go to SiouxFallsComedy.com. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we are wrapping up our hour on modern comedy in South Dakota by taking a look backward to a playwright famous for his 400-year-old comedies. And you can still see his work performed live in the state. Jana Gearhart Fitzsimmons is the artistic director of the Bear Bodkins Theater Company, which puts on a William Shakespeare production every summer at Falls Park. She's also an assistant professor of theater at Augustana University. Dr. Fitzsimmons joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. And who better to talk about to go back 400 years or so and talk about William Shakespeare, tragedy and comedy.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your experience with Shakespeare over the years from the comedy standpoint, which isn't always limited to his comedies, of course.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the beauty of Shakespeare, is that his comedy is not confined to the plays that are classified as comedies. They're everywhere in the canon of his work. He is a master of blending genres. That's one of the most beautiful things about working with Shakespeare, I think.
Yeah.
And so... working with Shakespeare has been a really important part of my life since I was, just getting my start as a theater artist. And so when I think about kind of my first experiences with Shakespeare, kind of early kind of formative moments with his comedy, something that was really freeing was to just sit down with his plays and read them and imagine them in my mind. And something that was really rewarding and fun was that, oh my gosh, this is funny. This clicks. This makes sense. And so I think that Shakespeare's comedies can be a really great entry point for people who maybe don't think they like Shakespeare, or maybe are a little like hesitant, or maybe even a little suspicious or a little Shakespeare ambivalent.
Yeah.
I think the comedies are a wonderful door to open into the rest of his work. And so I've been really fortunate over the years to get to work as an actor and as a director and really deal with a wide variety of Shakespeare's plays. But the comedies definitely have a special place in my heart.
And he kind of does it all in the sense that there's wordplay and puns and humor that maybe you might not even get because of the speed that it goes by. But then you also have situational comedy and physical comedy and kind of all of it. Was there something that he really shown at? Or is that why Shakespeare is Shakespeare? Because he was so good at all of it.
You know, I think that's one of the reason that he's so enduring, I think, is because he's really tapping into a lot of human things. And what is more human than humor or comedy? And one of his gifts that he gives us in his work is that, like you were saying, he uses comedy in so many different ways. So it's really something for everybody. And that really reflects the situation in early modern England, where you had everybody coming to the theater of all classes. And so there was more highbrow humor, there was more lowbrow humor, everything in between. And that's something that's really fun to work with actors on today because, yeah, we get that wordplay, that kind of sentence-level comedy, that really clever, witty comedy with the language. But also at the same time, then sometimes we get fart jokes and sometimes we get, you know, that physical comedy that really leaps off the page. So there's something for everybody, I think, in all of Shakespeare's plays, but with comedy, we get a lot of variety.
So I think of how the theaters were designed, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you've read anything academic about laughs landing differently in different parts of the theater. Like, would you be in a show and the aristocratic people would laugh at one thing, but then the people up front in the groundlings would laugh at something else?
I think that's absolutely, I always tell my students, I really wish for a time machine. Like, I would really love to go back and experience what it was like to be a part of the theater going culture in that era. But what we do know from the text and what scholars point to is that this was something where, there was definitely kind of jokes or moments in the play that were geared towards different groups in the audience. And we know that there was a lot of interaction between what was happening on stage and what was happening in the crowd because there weren't kind of these barriers between the stage action and the audience in the way that there maybe are now. We think about our theater going experience today. We come into the theater, we take our assigned seat, we sit, the lights go down, and we're in the darkness in the audience, and then the lights shine on the stage. And we have this sort of convention of the fourth wall where the audience maybe doesn't, or sorry, the performers don't acknowledge us in the audience.
Yeah.
That's totally different than in Shakespeare's time. When everyone was coming to the theater very often during the day, outdoors, there was a lot of things happening during, like in the audience, people were talking, moving about, eating, drinking. And of course, a lot of interaction with the audience that was scripted and unscripted. One of my favorite conventions of Shakespeare performance is the aside. So one of the actors on stage kind of breaking what we would think of today as the fourth wall and kind of saying something directly to the audience, commenting on the action that's happening on stage. And that is used for many, many comedic purposes all across Shakespeare.
What are some of the themes? I think of mistaken identity.
Yes.
And, you know, being in the wrong place and confused for someone else and then chaos ensues.
Always chaos ensuing. We love that. Mistaken identity is one of my favorite conventions of Shakespeare humor. Yeah. And part of this is maybe because a lot of mistaken, there's instances of mistaken identity in Shakespeare that is about twins. Twins that are separated somehow, and then they're kind of mistaken for one another to comedic ends. And I'm an identical twin myself, and so I may be biased. I have a special fondness for those plays because, as an identical twin, that was something that we always kind of schemed about. Ooh, could we switch places? Could we fool people? And we were always too, like, rule-abiding to actually do it. So I get to sort of have that wish fulfillment in Shakespeare that I didn't get to do in my life. But, mistaken identity is a big part of it, whether it's kind of those stories of twins separated at birth, or characters in disguise. Eavesdropping is a big part of this too, where we have people overhearing things that maybe they aren't supposed to, or kind of a spin on that is when characters kind of create a situation that they want another character to overhear for comedic purposes. Mm-hmm. So there's some really fun elements of disguise and mistaken identity in the comedies that I always look forward to reading.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the use of comedy in the tragedy. You're staging Hamlet in Bear Bodkins coming up.
We have Hamlet to look forward to this summer. It's not a comedy.
Famously, I don't think we have to explain that Hamlet is not a comedy, but is there comic relief? Does he always give us something in the play? Somebody's job is to be the person we laugh at?
Yeah, that's a really important element of Shakespeare's tragedies, is that even when we have a very tragic story, dark things are happening, violent things are happening, Shakespeare finds ways to sprinkle in comedic moments. A sort of, sometimes it feels like a pressure release valve for the audience, sure. where we have something really dark happening, like in Macbeth, where we have a scene where the Macbeth and Lady Macbeth have resolved that they're going to commit a murder. They go off stage to do it. And the very next scene is a really hilarious moment where we have this kind of bumbling porter who's drunk and he comes in and he's needing to answer the door early in the wee hours of the morning, and he kind of has this interaction with the audience where that's like this really comedic bit. We only see that character in that one scene. Mm-hmm. And so there he is to kind of provide this comic relief in this moment we really need it, where Shakespeare has built tension and then we get a chance to laugh in the audience.
Yeah.
Hamlet kind of offers us something similar, where we have a very tragic plot, but we have moments where we have either, as you were saying, those characters whose job it is to come in and provide that comic relief, and we also have comedy kind of sprinkled throughout. So a lot of people, when they think about the comedy in Hamlet, they're thinking about the grave diggers. Sure. And so these are characters that kind of show up a little later in the play, and we see them kind of going about their work together, preparing a grave that we find out is for Ophelia, one of the mm-hmm. main characters in the play, Hamlet's love interest. And so we get to kind of have this like tension, this moment where, you know, we know what it is they're doing. The audience is aware, but they're just kind of going about their day. And it's just a regular day for them. And they're singing and they're laughing and joking and kind of speculating about the kind of morality of the person for whom they're digging this grave. Yeah. And then we find out through Hamlet's eyes what is actually happening.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, that sort of turns the moment.
Yeah.
So I think something that I really love about how Shakespeare is using comedy in the tragedies is the way that it provides such a stark contrast.
Sure.
So we really are getting these kind of high highs and low lows, and it's a lot of variety that we get to enjoy as audience members and readers and performers and directors.
And we see this today in theater, mm-hmm. in film, in commercials, any storytelling that I laughed, I cried,
yeah.
That's the cliche, because you want all those experiences from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite Shakespeare comedies to see on stage or to read if somebody wants a good laugh?
Yeah. My favorite Shakespeare comedy is Much Ado About Nothing.
Okay.
I really love it. It's silly. It's fun. It has it all. It's another one of those plays that really has a lot of variety. And that one is about kind of frenemies. If you were a fan of the, kind of enemies to lovers trope in mm-hmm. romance, I think that Much Ado About Nothing is for you. And there's some really wonderful film adaptations to enjoy. But yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Any final thoughts, or should we leave it here? This just seems like a good reading list or movie list. Any other films that you think people that have been inspired by or are about Shakespeare, or adaptations of Shakespeare, that are particularly fun?
I think you really kind of can't go wrong. Yeah. And I think if you have an open mind, and like I said, I think the comedies can just be such a wonderful doorway into the works of Shakespeare. So, if there are listeners who are kind of unsure about Shakespeare, whether it's reading or watching, my advice is always just to take a chance on it, give it a try. And especially with the work that we do in Falls Park every summer with Bear Bodkins, we always hope that people will embrace kind of our mission, which is that Shakespeare is for everybody. Yeah. And I think the comedies really help us understand that. It is for everybody. It's for us, and it's for today.
I love that. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for the invitation.
That's Jaina Gearhart Fitzsimmons, Assistant Professor of Theater at Augustana, and she is also Artistic Director of the Bear Bodkins Theater Company. Company stages performances of Hamlet during the first few weeks of July. We will have some links where you can learn more on our website. That's sdpb.org/news. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.